From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Can we talk about gun control? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In the aftermath of the latest mass shooting, even gun control advocates concede that new legislation is already dead on arrival. But Second Amendment purists aren't getting far either by insisting that the Aurora Theater would have been safer if every moviegoer had carried a gun. Is there some way to safeguard the Second Amendment at the same time protecting against gun violence? Is a presidential election year the best time or the worst time to come to terms with a deadly menace and a divided electorate? On Reporter's Notebook later on, is it too late for Bashar al-Assad? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. In the aftermath of the massacre in Aurora, Colorado, New York Mayor Bloomberg wants President Obama and candidate Mitt Romney to talk about gun violence. Could that possibly be a winning issue for either side? What's the history of gun control? Are multiple killings America's new normal? On Reporter's Notebook, the president of Syria was offered asylum in another country, but has he waited too long to leave? First is news update. British officials have ramped up the stakes in the phone hacking scandal involving officials in Rupert Murdoch's media empire. Criminal charges have been filed against Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks, both of whom have close ties to Prime Minister David Cameron. And there could be implications here in the United States. Andrew Edgecliff Johnson is media editor for the Financial Times. Welcome as always.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit more about Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks. What's the background?
Well, these are two individuals who are very close to, not just to Rupert Murdoch, having had senior editorial positions in his British newspaper empire, but also to David Cameron, the British Prime Minister. Rebecca Brooks was socially close to him. They lived in neighbouring villages in the country and went horse riding together. And David Cameron became his Director of Communications, so was actually appointed after he'd stepped down from the News of the World by David Cameron to work very closely with him. So it's an interesting reminder that this scandal has always been about more than just News Corp. It's obviously had been very damaging for News Corp, but it's also been about two other constituencies. One is David Cameron's government and the other is the police.
What is the nature of the charges filed today?
So these are the charges are that they were involved in phone hacking, and so prosecutors have decided that there's enough evidence to implicate them and six other individuals in this scandal. This obviously has been going in stages. We had the arrests of many of these people, and we've had actually 70 arrests now in the various investigations in the UK. These are the first big wave of charges. They will appear in court in August. And I think we can expect the process to take many, many months now. So this is far from being resolved. Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson and the other defendants are all saying they're going to fight these charges. This is early in the game, but obviously it's been 12 months since the hacking scandal really exploded in the UK. This is actually just one of three police investigations in the UK, and we obviously have many other investigations on both sides of the Atlantic.
Speaking of that, back in March, you wrote a story about two U.S. senators who are very interested in this case. They've written to the authorities in Britain. Tell us about that.
Yes, quite early on in this story, last July, after Rupert Murdoch closed the News of the World, after the discovery that it had hacked into the voicemail messages of a missing teenage girl who turned out to have been murdered, the outcry prompted senators to ask for investigations by the DOJ, the FBI, and the SEC. Now, none of those bodies have said very much about this process yet, but from our investigations, it seems as though the US investigations are still open, that they are doing their own work to their own inquiries, looking for any evidence, particularly under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. But we're also told that they are waiting to see what comes out of the British investigation. So if these cases amount to nothing, then it may well be, in Britain, it may well be that there is in the US, but if there is any sort of severe penalty from either the criminal prosecutions, the civil cases that have been separately brought by victims of phone hacking, the regulatory inquiries by Ofcom, the UK media regulator, or the Leveson inquiry, which was set up by the Prime Minister to look into the practices of the British press, then we're in much more uncertain territory in the US.
Takes you 5 minutes just to list the number of investigations that are ongoing. I said you wrote that story in March. In fact, it was in May, on the 2nd of May. Well, how dangerous is this for David Cameron and his government?
I think the politics of it are complicated. This is a government that's trying to push through an austerity agenda. It's not an obviously popular thing to try and do. They're in a coalition with the Liberal Democrats. The Labour Party has obviously tried to make headway with this story, but has also been quite implicated in the cosiness that David Cameron is accused of having enjoyed with these News International executives. So a lot of the evidence presented to the Leveson inquiry has been about contact between Rupert Murdoch and his editors and Tony Blair or Gordon Brown, the two previous Labour prime ministers. So it is actually quite a difficult one for the major parties in Britain to score points on. But I think what we're going to see above and beyond this Metropolitan Police process that is grabbing the headlines today is the Leveson inquiry reporting. The judge running the Leveson inquiry finished hearing evidence today. He's actually listened to more than 100 days of submissions from more than 650 witnesses. So he has to process that into some sort of ruling that's going to touch on politicians as much as it does on the press.
We will be watching that. Andrew Edgecliffe Johnson, as always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Media editor for the Financial Times. In a moment, can we talk about gun control? On To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and only back with To the Point. In 1929, American newspapers carried sensational pictures of crumpled dead bodies, victims of Al Capone's St. Valentine's Day massacre. President Franklin Roosevelt then persuaded Congress to restrict access to machine guns favored by gangsters. Since then, there have been many more multiple shootings, but the result has more often been sympathy rather than action. UCLA professor Adam Winkler is author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, all of this occurs in the aftermath of what happened Friday in Aurora, Colorado, and there have been calls for gun control, but there have also been the point made that doesn't seem now to be the kind of outrage that is likely to lead to action. And so far, no public figure other than the mayor of New York and a couple of others have called for there to be a great debate. Now, give us a little bit of the history of this issue.
Well, we have a long history of the right to bear arms in America. We obviously have the Second Amendment, and state constitutional law has long protected the right of individuals to own guns. But at the same time, we've always had gun control laws. The Founding Fathers had gun control laws that today's NRA leaders would never accept. And even the Wild West, the heart of America's gun culture, had the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation. But today, when we see these mass shootings, it really doesn't stimulate us to take up that historical cause and fight for gun control.
Under what circumstances have atrocities led, actually, to increases in gun control?
Well, we do see that in the past. So you mentioned Al Capone and the St. Valentine's Day Massacre of 1929. New York's Sullivan Law, one of the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation, passed in 1911 after an attempted assassination of the city's mayor. And even in the 1960s, we saw Congress pass the Gun Control Act of 1968, just after the back-to-back assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy.
What about the shooting of, or the attempted shooting of Ronald Reagan?
Well, Ronald Reagan was shot in 1981, and I think a sign of how strong the NRA had already become by that time and how important a part of it was of Ronald Reagan's coalition is that Reagan came out and said, we don't need any new gun control laws. For the NRA and for that sort of conservative coalition in America, gun control was just another example of failed government efforts.
Why do you put so much emphasis on the NRA?
Well, the NRA is the leading gun control organization in America. It is not the only voice for the gun rights movement by far, but it is certainly the most powerful one and has the most influence in Washington.
Have any politicians tried to buck the NRA since 1981?
Well, sure, politicians do buck the NRA. Bill Clinton bucked the NRA and pushed for a law that would provide for some background checks on some gun purchases and also for the federal assault weapons ban that expired in 2004. He thought, Bill Clinton himself said, that the reason why Republicans gained a majority in Congress for the first time since in half a century was because of these gun control efforts.
How likely do you think it is that as a result of Mayor Bloomberg's call or anybody else's that President Obama and Mitt Romney are going to have a debate about gun control?
I don't think there's any chance. Both men have a history of supporting gun control, but they will avoid this issue at all costs this year. Right now, gun control is seen to be an electoral loser. You know, Mayor Bloomberg said that the gun control movement needs leaders. I think the real truth is that the gun control movement needs followers. Americans voice their support for gun control, but few Americans vote for gun control.
Adam Winkler again at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Here's what U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California, who was in fact the author of the assault weapons ban that expired some years ago, had to say just the last couple of days.
President Obama, Mr. Romney, I think they should give it a lot of consideration. I think this is a bad time to raise a new subject, but there has been no action. And there has been no action because there's been no outrage out there. People haven't rallied forward.
Again, Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California. Dan Gross is president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Brady, of course, the man who was with President Reagan when he was shot. Mr. Brady also shot, managed to survive, and lead that organization. It's now led by Dan Gross, who is the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Thanks a lot to you for joining us today.
Good to be here.
Do you agree with Adam Winkler that, and essentially with Senator Feinstein, that there's no chance that this is going to be an issue in this presidential campaign?
I can't agree. I mean, the one thing that I do differ a little bit with what Senator Feinstein said is I do think that the outrage is out there. I just think it hasn't been harnessed. And I truly believe that if we can harness, you know, I'm hearing it. I'm president of the Brady Campaign, and, you know, I'm kind of a receptacle for all of the outrage and disgust and frustration that's out there. And you know, the American public knows we are better than this. And it's just the question of harnessing that outrage to let our elected officials know that we're watching them and that we're holding them accountable. And I have to believe, otherwise we should all just go home, that if we can harness the common sense out there and the outrage of the average American and the notion that we are as a nation better than this, that we can force change.
President Obama indicated in his first campaign that gun control was of interest to him. That sparked an enormous outcry on the other side of the aisle. You've given him an F on gun control. Explain what that means.
He hasn't lived up to the words. He's done a couple of little things, but he hasn't done anything nearly as sweeping as the kind of things that he was talking about, or impactful as the kind of things that he was talking about in his election. In his most noteworthy speech, probably of his whole campaign, he talked in Denver in his acceptance speech about an assault weapons ban, which very well could have prevented this tragedy if it had been in place. But he after the tragedy last year in Tucson, he called for a national dialogue. But unfortunately, to this point, his voice and his leadership have been missing from that dialogue.
The incident last week did involve an assault weapon, but it involved a lot of other weapons as well that wouldn't have been affected by the assault weapons ban. Are you sure the whole incident would have been prevented had that been in effect?
No, and I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't think we should predicate policy or pushes for policy around any one specific tragedy. I think we have to come to the table, people who own guns and people who don't, with a fundamental belief in the Second Amendment as it's been decided by the Supreme Court. The Second Amendment does give a right to bear arms, but as Adam Winkler was saying, it has also been decided that it can be regulated. What can we do in the context of everybody's beliefs and rights that will save the most lives. And if we can all come to the table in that context with this fundamental belief that we are as a nation better than this, that we can do something about this. So, you know, this whole idea of looking at the issue just through the prism of one single tragedy, there's a lot of outrage, very appropriately, over this tragedy. But that same day, there were probably four times that number of people killed by guns across America. And we have to look at the tragedy of gun violence as a whole in order to determine what we can best do about it.
So what do we do then? What would you advocate? And in what way are you changing your strategy, given the fact that for the past few years it doesn't seem to have worked?
We're getting back to basics with the Brady campaign. You know, we've always been the voice of the American people on this issue, and it's certainly what we've been when we've been most effective. And we know that the overwhelming majority of Americans support sensible laws like background checks. The polling shows it. So we're all about creating that national conversation in the context of a respect for the Supreme Court decision in the Second Amendment, and most fundamentally a respect for the value of human life, and engaging the American public in a demand for change. So we've created a website that's separate from the Brady site that is wearebetterthanthis.org. And on there is a petition to President Obama and Governor Romney from the American people demanding that they make this part of their campaigns and that they provide not just sympathy, which is very appropriate for the leader of our nation to provide, but also solutions, which I would argue it's even more appropriate for the leader of our nation to survive, to provide.
But you're not including solutions in the petition?
No, because first it's about listening. It's about engaging the American public. It's about all coming to the table with this idea of we are better than this, and how can we save lives with this respect for the Second Amendment. And once we, you know, really listen to the American public and hear the anger and the outrage and the proposed solutions, we will come out the other side with a focused policy agenda. But like I said before, I don't think that should be driven by one specific tragedy. I think that should be driven by how we can best end this tragedy of gun violence in our nation as a whole.
Adam Winkler, back to you, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. You said you don't think there's a chance that Obama and Romney are going to go anywhere near this issue. What would it take for the kind of petition Dan Gross is proposing, do you think, to get their attention?
Well, I think what's going to get their attention is not a petition, although I compliment the Brady Center for trying to do more to get the American public focused on the gun control issue. I think the real thing is that gun control support is pretty high in polls. If you ask people, do we want a law that bans terrorists, people on the terrorist watch list from being able to buy guns, they say overwhelmingly 88-89% that they support that law. If you ask them if they support a law favoring expanding the federal background check system, they say yes by overwhelming margins. What they're not doing is giving money to the Brady Center. What they're not doing is going out and making this the single issue that they will vote on. In a democracy, the power goes to those who can deliver votes. And whether it's accurate or not, people think that the NRA is the one that delivers votes. And gun control groups like the Brady Center haven't been able to deliver the vote so far.
Let me introduce you to Richard Feldman. He's a former lobbyist for the National Rifle Association. He's president now of the Independent Firearms Owners Association, and he's author of Ricochet, Confessions of a Gun Lobbyist. Richard Feldman, good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
You defected from the NRA for reasons of your own. You're still, however, a gun advocate. What do you think about the effort that Dan Gross and the Brady campaign are making with this campaign and the idea that we are better than this? Are we?
Well, somehow I tend to doubt that deranged lunatics are going to hear that message, and I'm sure that's not what Dan is implying, and sit down and say, I guess I won't go on a lunatic rampage and kill a bunch of people. That, in a sense, that this is the toughest of all the issues surrounding the misuse of guns. There's the negligent misuse, the criminal misuse, and the crazy misuse. This wasn't to rob someone. And this is the one that really defies, and here's the perfect example. The guy hadn't been involved in the criminal justice system, didn't have a criminal history, hadn't been into the mental history system. What it shows is that our safety net in this country is very poor, but it has a lot less to do with guns than it has to do with the nature of our society and the stresses that people are feeling. Lord knows that you don't need a gun to kill a lot of people. One of the worst instances of a single individual as a mass murderer occurred 15 years ago in the Bronx, New York, the Happy Land fire. The individual bought a gallon of gasoline, at that time probably a buck and a quarter, and killed 87 people in that fire. You don't need a gun to do it. And when we focus on the gun, we miss the opportunity in this country to focus on the problem, which is always in whose hands are the guns.
Dan Gross, quickly, with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, how do you respond to that?
First of all, after a big fire, we look at things that we can do in terms of regulation and policy to prevent that so many people from dying. And I think everything has to be on the table. Yeah, the things that he's talking about are worthwhile exploring in terms of the safety net and all that, but they're not worthwhile at the expense of exploring the role that the guns play. And I agree with what he said last, what we can do to keep guns, for example, out of the hands of dangerous people. And there is policy that can prevent that, like the background checks that the gun lobby fights against every time it's ever proposed, and the politicians who do their bidding fight against every time it's proposed. You know, there's a question of enforcing laws that already exist, convicted felons not allowed to have a gun, but we have no way, unfortunately, with 40% of all gun sales, to find out if a convicted felon is trying to buy a gun. So this idea of writing off, blanketly writing off policy as part of the solution, you just have to question the agenda of anybody who would propose that. Why shouldn't we consider every possible aspect of it? It's always, you know, let's talk about everything but the potential of policy to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people.
Richard,
it also speaks.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get back to Richard Feldman briefly before we need to go to a break, which is in less than a minute. But, Mr. Feldman, what about background checks? Would that have helped last week?
Absolutely not. He went through the background check. He passed the background check and would have passed under any set of circumstances that anyone has come up with today.
Okay. We're going to leave it at that for the moment. As I said, we need to go to a break. We can come back and continue this conversation with our current guest and others as well. Later on, we'll ask, is it too late for President Bashar al-Assad to get out of Syria? He has been offered asylum, but he hasn't taken it. There's some question now as to whether it is even that offer is even extended to him. We'll talk about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman, on back with To the Point in the aftermath of the shooting last week in Aurora, Colorado. We are talking about gun control. Is there any prospect that the presidential candidates might raise this issue? So far, our guests don't seem to believe so, although Dan Gross of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence is hopeful that they may take it up. Hubert Williams is chair of the National Law Enforcement Partnership to Prevent Gun Violence. That's a collaboration among 10 national law enforcement groups. He himself is a 40-year veteran of policing, and he was police director in Newark for 11 years. Hubert Williams, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you. It's good to be on the program.
Chime in here with what we've been hearing about what it is you think very specifically might work, that might have been used, for example, or deployed to prevent what happened that tragedy last week in the movie theater.
Well, first of all, let me say that back in 1994, when the law enforcement community organized after the shooting that took Brady down and President Reagan got hit, and violence was sprouting up around the nation, police being threatened, we police officers came from all over the United States to the Capitol. They gathered in police headquarters in Washington, D.C. They marched up to Capitol Hill, many of them were in wheelchairs and canes, and asked for stronger policies and gun control. The Brady Bill was passed, and assault assault weapons was banned, cop killer bullets was eliminated, machine guns was banned. I think Congress has the primary responsibilities because they put into the legislation for the 1994 Crime Control Act a provision for the assault weapon ban that existed for a period of 10 years to expire after 10 years. They cut it down, and it never came up again. If, in fact, that legislation had not expired, that individual would not have been able to purchase that weapon legally. Let me say this, that the...
But he could have pushed, if I may interrupt you, he could have purchased the other weapons that he used. He had an arsenal with him.
And the thing is, there are levels of risk, threats, and dangers. We should not have on American streets, from my personal perspective, battlefield weapons that's used in war. They're certainly not used for purposes of hunting. There's no sports purpose for that. Some people would argue that if you wanted a tank, you should get one, and you should be able to get one. There should be no prohibition or limitations on weapons that you can buy, irrespective of the threat that it poses to the public. They would argue it's our Second Amendment right. Well, at least we can say, let me say this, that in 1968, the gun control legislation required a background check for anybody purchasing a firearm, and it precluded certain classes of individuals. Would not have stopped this guy from getting his weapon, but 40% of the weapons purchased today are outside of that law. That law said that any person purchasing a weapon from a licensed federal dealer must get a background check. Now 40% of the people getting those weapons don't get background checks. I think we've got to basically strengthen our laws, and it can be done in a way that it does not endanger the rights of people to own weapons. But certainly, that legislation still exists, and the law enforcement community is arguing that the 1968 Gun Control Crime Control Act standards should be applied to the purchase of any weapons. Between 1994 and 2004, 1,925,000 people that applied for licenses to purchase weapons were denied those weapons because they failed to meet the standards prescribed. They were either serious criminals, mental problems, etc. I don't think that after each incident we can come up with a solution for the incident. What we've got to do is come up with a solution for the problem and minimize the hazards and dangers that the American public is faced with because of people getting these weapons that should never have them. And that is a key, I think, that everyone has agreed on, that to keep weapons out of the hands of the wrong people. The large percentage of the American public, including 81% of gun owners, believe that background checks should be applied to people purchasing firearms. It would be wonderful if we could get unanimity on that issue, since the background checks are already required for people purchasing firearms from licensed federal dealers. But the back door is the gun shows and private dealers. And like this individual was able to purchase 6,000 rounds of ammunition on the Internet, they can also purchase guns on the Internet. And we need to have standards that ensure if these gun organizations really believe what they say, guns don't kill, people do, then they should be taking every effort to make sure that guns are kept out of the hands of the wrong people.
Richard Feldman, back to you. Formerly with the NRA, now with the Independent Firearms Association, author of Ricochet, Confessions of a Gun Lobbyist. Would you agree with what the former police director of Newark, Mr. Williams, just told us? And are you in favor, then, of restrictions on the people rather than the guns?
Well, Mr. Williams is confused about some of the laws and what they did and didn't do. And as I'm sure he knows but didn't portray, even during the assault weapons ban, all the guns manufactured beforehand were still legal as long as they were manufactured before. So there are millions and millions and millions of guns out there that you're not going to outlaw. After all, it was President Obama promised he wasn't going to take away anybody's lawfully owned guns. When we focus on this one incident of a crazed individual, as horrible as the tragedy is, to make national policy affecting the decisions of millions and millions of people who are not misusing the guns.
But Mr. Williams just said we shouldn't do that. We shouldn't base it all on the most
recent
incident.
Oh, he would like to ban certain classes of guns. Look, I think it's a lot easier than that. Any assault weapon is a gun that's pointed at me. And any gun in my hands is a defensive device that I can use just like a police officer to defend myself, my family, my community.
So should all the people in that movie theater have been armed then?
I'm sorry?
Should all the people in that movie theater then have been armed?
No, of course not. But, you know, when you ask the question, gee, should there have been armed people, let me ask this question. Would it have been such a terrible thing had there been four, coincidentally, what if there were four undercover Aurora police officers just coincidentally watching that show with their families in that theater? Would that have been a horrible thing to have occurred? I think not.
Let me go back to Hubert Williams on that one. Would it have been appropriate for the officers in that situation to use their weapons, presuming they had them?
You know, I think what we're getting is arguments either for or against gun control. If you ask the law enforcement community what they think about this, they've tried to cut a path that would create some balance. They're strongly opposed to these clips that would hold 100 rounds or 50 rounds of ammunition. It would be good if some of these guests on the show would tell us what they're for and not what they're against. This argument that four cops sitting there undercover could have withstood an AK-47 and other people wouldn't have been seriously injured is really a joke. Every law enforcement official knows that. You are supposed to be protecting human lives, and you use your weapon when you can and not in the endangerment of human life. This argument that, millions of people had weapons, you're not going to take those weapons away. Let's take some baby steps to deal with this massive problem that's creating a threat to children and women and families in our country. Let's not just talk about what we're opposed to. Let's talk about some solutions. And that's what you don't hear from these people.
Earlier on our program, Dan Gross with the Brady Gun Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence mentioned terrorism and how differently we view that when it comes to trying to control people's behavior. David Sirota is a syndicated columnist. He's a writer for Salon.com, radio host on 630 KHOW in Denver, close, of course, to where the incident happened, author most recently of Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. David Sirota, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
You made that point about terrorism. Elaborate on it a bit, if you will, in a recent column.
The point is that we make a distinction between terrorism and regular crime that doesn't really make much sense anymore. And the media was very quick to say that the atrocity in Aurora wasn't terrorism, when in fact there was all sorts of military-style planning that went into this kind of assault. And the point here is that we say as a nation that we're willing to do certain things when we deem a crime terrorism, and we basically say we're not necessarily willing to do those things when we deem an atrocity simple crime. And I think that we make those distinctions based on preconceived assumptions that aren't necessarily all that relevant or all that applicable. How do we know this guy wasn't a terrorist? How do we define terrorism? And if we're willing to abrogate all sorts of constitutional rights when it comes to privacy and civil liberties in the face of terrorism, why are we not even willing to have a discussion about even mild gun control in the face of this kind of what I would call terrorism?
So should we call this terrorism then? And if so, how would we define it and how would we prevent against it?
I think we can't not call it terrorism based on what we know so far, that ruling it out is a real problem. And we've seen this happen with various events. When we've seen the guy fly the plane into the IRS building, there's been all sorts of mass killings. Gun violence may be down, but mass killings are up. And typically when it is a white male it is ruled as just somebody snapped, somebody is deranged, and it's not terrorism. And I think that narrows the discussion. And I think that we do need to have a conversation as a country about whether this really is terrorism. I mean, just because somebody has one political motive behind a horrible atrocity doesn't mean they're a terrorist, and somebody having a different motive, a different potentially political motive behind their atrocity doesn't mean that should be considered just regular crime.
So you'd separate the terrorism from the politics.
Exactly. We're essentially politicizing the word terrorism to say that it applies only to, primarily to, Islamic fundamentalist motivated terrorism, when in fact terrorism comes in all sorts of sizes, shapes, and locations. And if we're going to be honest about security, having a real discussion about security, we have to broaden that discussion.
How do we get specific about that then? Would we all have to go through metal detectors before we went into the movies?
Well, I'm not saying that terrorism, any kind of terrorism, always requires a Patriot Act style response. But it is to say that if we're going to put certain things on the table when it comes to Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, then we should be willing to put moderate things on the table when it comes to other forms of terrorism. I mean, if you really think about it, think about how much we've given up in terms of constitutional liberties in the fight against Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, and yet we're having trouble even having a discussion about right now the most minimal forms of gun regulation. Just the assault weapons ban, reinstating something that wasn't so radical that was on the books. That hypocrisy is a real problem.
David Sirota again, a syndicated columnist in Denver. Dan Gross, back to you with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Is that a helpful idea? Dan Gross, you still with us? Hubert Williams, let me put that to you. Again, chair of the National Law Enforcement Partnership to Prevent Gun Violence. Is that a helpful new way of thinking?
Well, I think he's correct, but I don't think it's going to really modify or change anything. Because if we were really trying to prevent terrorism, we have about 500,000 people walking across our borders every year. All they have to do, if they wanted to make an attack, is go into a gun store and get the weapons, and then they could make the attack. I think we've got to be cognizant of the fact that the people out on the streets protecting American lives are police officers. And I was just a couple of months ago at the law enforcement memorial where 19,000 officers' names are carved who died in the line of duty. I don't know how it's possible to provide for protections when the police are being outgunned out there with these heavy-duty weapons unless the police try to match these weapons and also get the manpower to do the job. And where are we going in terms of our country? See, I think that the issue of terrorism is a legitimate issue, the fact that we deal with it differently. But to me, the fundamental thing is we need to try and ensure that the rights of the American public are protected and that the American public's safety and security is paramount in the in the minds of public officials.
So David Sirota, can you tell us how we would act specifically different than we do now if, in fact, we considered such crimes as we saw last week as terrorism?
I think a lot of things would be on the table. I think we'd actually have a real congressional debate about reinstating the assault weapons ban. I think there would be a discussion about how to prevent people who are not psychologically stable from having access to weapons. On my radio show yesterday, one caller floated the idea, why don't we mandate that everybody gets a doctor's note if you want to buy an assault weapon, certifying your psychological stability. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily the exact thing we should do, but I'm saying that if we're willing to abrogate our constitutional liberties in the face of Islamic terrorism, if we're willing to put up metal detectors at airports, spending billions and billions of dollars on the Department of Homeland Security when it comes to one form of terrorism, then we should at least put other things on the table when it comes to our domestic security, especially in the face of an act that I think many, many facts in this Aurora massacre point to somebody who was looking to terrorize a larger community.
Adam Winkler, let me go back to you, our first guest, constitutional law professor at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Have we reached a point, do you think, where, despite what Dan Gross says about all the outrage that he hears as a kind of repository for this kind of anger after such an incident, that we've come to see this as a sort of new normal and almost business as usual?
Well, in some ways, it seems that we have. Americans really do support the right of individuals to have guns, and like all of our constitutional rights, sometimes there are public safety hazards that come from the exercise of those rights. Look, we have a right to remain silent and a right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Those are protections essentially for criminal defendants, people who've committed crimes, and because government has stopped from doing something, they'll probably go out and commit more crimes. That's not to make to marginalize the importance of this issue or to diminish the idea that we can go and do more to prevent the 80 people that die every day from guns from dying. But it does tell us that, you know, in America, the right to bear arms is something that really is viewed as sacred. And I think that it's really incumbent upon the gun control community and gun control voters, if they want to push for more laws and to readjust the balance, to fight harder come Election Day.
Richard Feldman, again with the Independent Firearms Owners Association, formerly with the NRA. Give us two ideas that you would propose for ways of coping with these two issues. One, the Second Amendment right, and two, the right to be free of violence.
Well, I don't know that we have a right to be free from violence. It would be nice. It would be a bit nicer country, but we have to protect ourselves from not the unusual circumstance, which fortunately Aurora was, but the more common experience, which is a street robbery, a mugging. That's where you're much more likely to encounter the misuse of a gun.
So personal self-defense is your answer.
Well, it's only a part of an answer. It's too complicated a question to give you some pat answer that answers everything. Everything's tied in with everything else here, with our whole war on drugs and the resources in law enforcement that we expend on incarcerating and prosecuting marijuana users instead of focusing on the violent sorts of crime that the American people would like to lower. We don't use our law enforcement resources very wisely in this country. We spend a lot of money, but we don't focus on the kind of technology concerns and the apparatus available today through IBIS program of identifying who's committing the crimes and apprehending the bad guys.
Okay, let me go back finally to Dan Gross again, the president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. You're going to have a petition, wearebetterthanthis.com. What is your highest and best hope for that?
It's wearebetterthanthis.org, and I just want to point out, when you ask a question like that to anybody from the gun lobby for specifics, you always get a dizzying answer like the one that you just got. Let me give you the answer of something that we could do that would tangibly save lives, that would tangibly keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. If we passed background checks that kept guns out of the hands of convicted felons, convicted domestic abusers, terrorists, and people found to be dangerously mentally ill. And, you know, we put a statement of principle, we sent it out to all of Congress to ask them to sign that statement of principle, saying that they just believe that those people shouldn't be able to buy, own, or carry guns in our nation. And we are getting very few positive responses. That is how messed up what is going on in Washington, D.C. is today. And until we engage the American public in this issue, I think those comments are exactly right. I don't think we have a lot of hope for change. But I have hope that through wearebetterthanthis.org, we are going to be able to engage the American public in an outcry that's going to demand change. And, you know, if we really do believe that we're better than this, we do need to make this a voting issue. And that's what Brady's focused on doing.
Thank you all very much for being on our program. Good to have you with us. Saddam Hussein was found in a spider hole. Muammar Gaddafi was gunned down by his own people. Bashar Assad was offered asylum from Syria. Is it too late to take it? Back in a moment with To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warman Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The new president of Tunisia told the BBC, if the price of peace in Syria is to give a safe haven to this guy, why not? Meaning President Bashar Assad. But that was in March. Since then, no other leader has made a similar offer. That's according to Vivian Walt in Time magazine. Vivian Walt, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Has the president of Tunisia even renewed his offer, or is there any indication at this point that there's any haven available to the president of Syria?
Well, the Tunisian president has not renewed his offer since April, in fact, and in my discussions with some of his top aides, it seems much more difficult for him to do so or for any other leader to do so. It's a very tricky thing. You're talking about March, where there were not thousands of people dead yet, or certainly not more than 10,000. And now, whereas we're in fact, you're dealing with a civil war in which you are going to very much be giving sanctuary to possibly a war criminal.
What about Russia?
Russia has pointedly refused to offer Bashar al-Assad sanctuary. They have rebuffed several hints that perhaps they ought to do so, and they've told numerous reporters on numerous different occasions that they don't intend doing so. This does not seem to be a very obvious option for Assad.
Would it appear that he faces the same fate then as Muammar Gaddafi or perhaps Saddam Hussein?
Well, in talking to people who watch Syria very closely, and in fact today I was on the line with some people in Damascus itself, people seem increasingly to believe that he is headed towards some kind of violent end, and that in fact there were several months last year, several months this year, when he could have slipped away into some kind of obscure exile. Possibly there might have been charges in his absence, but nonetheless, he could have got his family out to exile, and that this kind of option has narrowed quite steadily over the last few months and quite quickly, I would say, over the last 2 or 3 weeks. So it does seem at this point that he is fighting to the bitter end.
Is there any evidence that he has attempted to get his wife or other members of his family out of the country?
Well, Warren, there have been a lot of rumors the last week that she and the kids are now out of Damascus and that they might have gone to Latakia, which is a coastal place on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast of Syria. And it's also the traditional place for Alawite Syrians, the sect which Assad belongs to. So it is possible that the family is there. They have a family house. But nonetheless, they certainly are not out of Syria. And at this point, it would be almost impossible for them to leave the country. There are international sanctions on which they are listed by name as being unable to travel. And so no country is going to allow them in if they do happen to get on a plane.
If a fight to the death is what we are seeing begin here, is it more likely that either President al-Assad or other members of his administration would use chemical weapons against their own people?
Well, this is a very big question, and of course they raised this as a threat yesterday. The foreign ministry spokesman in a press conference yesterday did make this kind of a threat that they were prepared to use chemical weapons. However, he said, on foreigners, not on Syrians. Nonetheless, they believe that most of the opposition militants are foreigners, and therefore one could imagine them trying to justify a chemical attack on some militant stronghold. It seems to me, just from reading the situation, that there is quite a lot of posing involved in this, and that this is really for the consumption of foreign governments rather than as a warning to locals, and that really it's a way of telling the West, stay out, don't get embroiled in another situation like Iraq, which, of course, is only just next door Syria, and that, you know, we could, in fact, take you down another very murky path that could be years and, you know, to resolve. So it seemed to me like it was more bluster than reality.
We didn't talk about Iran. Is it possible that Iran might offer sanctuary?
Well, of course, Iran has not been mentioned very much in this at all. And yes, I guess it is possible that they could simply go across the border into Iran. It's, however, It seems somewhat unlikely, and that it seems like if the Assads were to take refuge somewhere, it would be in a country that is far more stable, perhaps one of the Gulf countries, or perhaps ultimately Russia, if the world powers put enough pressure on President Putin to go down this road and create some kind of, as they put it, safe exit for the Assad family.
All right. Apparently, a grim future for the Assad family, certainly for the president himself. Vivian Walt, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Vivian Walt, Time magazine correspondent, joined us today from Paris. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Anna Scott and Sonia Geis. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.